It's one of the joys and one of the sadnesses of Holden is that the audience constantly is diminished and renewed, or the group that has a discussion going on. That's very nice in the sense that you get to meet new friends and new people. It's a little awkward in that you always have a feeling that you ought to start at the beginning and start over again. We've been trying in the last five, this is the fifth of a series of five discussions about in the law of marriage and divorce, primarily. We've been trying to develop, at least what I thought, was a sequence of ideas, starting with the notion of whether the policy of the law ought to be to protect individuals primarily, or whether it ought to be to protect institutions, communities, groups, marriages, families, and so forth. I thought that John Schramm did a nice job of illustrating that in the way last hour when he was talking about a concept of perhaps a Hebrew concept of the group or the community of social responsibility in tension with a rather more modern, perhaps New Testament idea of my God and I walk through the fields together as if it were a one-on-one rather than a one-to-a-community situation. It's a problem that runs through all of this. And then we talked a little bit about the law which deals with forming these groups, marriages or other kinds of relationships in life, and whether or not law can be helpful. We talked something about the relationship between adults and young people in our society and the law that deals with that. Yesterday, we talked about whether or not law can be helpful in preserving relationships that have been formed, or whether that's an extra legal, other than legal kind of function, where social work or Christian concern perhaps can do that, maybe law can't. Still, I think one must conclude that it's one of law's responsibilities to protect relationships from interference, to protect our concepts of ownership. Both Sig and John, in their messages to us yesterday morning, both in Matins and in the Sermon of the Evening, were most helpful about that in the parable of the vineyard, where we have the owner of a vineyard saying both things. I've made an agreement with you to work one day for a silver coin, and when I have paid you a silver coin, I have done what the law requires of me. At the same time saying, and what's more, I can be generous to other people if I wish, and to give them more than they have a legal demand. So you again get that correspondence or tension of these things that hold each other. This morning, I would like to try and conclude this series, hopefully before the hour is over, so that you can cross-examine me. Or so that you can express your ideas or exchange your thoughts among the other with the other members of the group. It's very difficult for me to say anything briefly. Jane says I can't say hello in less than 15 minutes, and that's probably true.
You gotta get shalom.
And so, yeah, I'd spend a half an hour explaining what I mean when I say shalom. Or trying to. I assume that the function of law is to try and make people's lives more shalom, to give us some richness, some reward, some happiness, some productivity. A little difficulty with the adjectives there, but I assume that the purpose of law is to help people. I personally view law as being a gift of God to man as a optional lifestyle for people. It's a way of living with each other when we have been unable to live with each other in the fullness and the richness of God's intended relationship of people to people and people to God and people to the world. Because we live in a fallen state where the whole of creation groans waiting for reconciliation, and because we are out of phase with God and with man and with our world, I'm born in this state of alienation. because that exists, there are times in which I must find some way of living with a person, not in the fullness of my family, not in the fullness of my church, but in a relationship of you take yours and I'll take mine, and I'll be honest and I'll be square, and you be honest and you be square. You are like the tax collector that I don't particularly like and I don't welcome, but I will deal with you honestly. I'm afraid I'm not going to love that function, but it's one that I must deal with in law, in integrity, even though it doesn't bring me great joy. Still, it's a necessary function. This, it seems to me, is what law is about. Now, with reference to families or other groupings of people, people who live together, people who have a joint venture, people who, in modern terminology, are consorting with each other rather than marrying, simply living together. Adults and children who are related to each other. If that's the best relationship that they can work out, if it's the most that they can accept, I suppose, though I would certainly understand argument on this point, I suppose that it's the law's function to make that crippled and incomplete relationship as meaningful and as helpful to those people as it can be. Or isn't it? Is it so adverse to the broader policies of society that we want to try and stomp out and eradicate those aberrant relationships and insist that everybody conforms to and adapts to the prescribed traditional models of relationship? That's a difficult problem that we have to face in our society. Now, when one of these relationships, whatever it may be, is in the process of deterioration, it isn't working, it isn't functioning, then I suppose that it's the law's function to ease the movement from being in that relationship to being out of that relationship, with the least amount of trauma, hurt, pain, to make it as smooth. These are dangerous words. To make it as easy, as unobstructed as possible. What I have just said is that where a man and a woman, or a parent and a child, or other persons have related themselves in a way that they have found not helpful, not productive, not workable. I take the classic case, the traditional case of marriage. That then, and now I'll put it instead of as a statement, as a question. Should it be the policy of the law to help that marriage which has failed be dissolved and release the persons as painlessly as possible? Or shall we throw up obstructions and say that, you may not terminate this relationship unless you can prove certain facts to have existed, unless you can overcome certain hindrances that we put in the way, thinking that those hindrances and making it difficult will reduce the number of terminations, may very well reduce the number of divorces by making them more difficult. You could, for example, put a price of $50,000 on every divorce. And that would certainly eliminate a lot of them. Better yet, we could eliminate marriage and we get all through with divorces. But somehow or other, those solutions seem to be very impractical, because they do, as we would say in our language, throw the baby out with the bathwater. They destroy the good out of fear of the evil. Now, it's easy to generalize about this, and I must not spend too much of our time together generalizing. Let's try to get down to some specifics about this. Dissolution of marriage in our society has become an increasingly common phenomenon. You all know that. It is said, for example, accurately, that in most states there will be one divorce or dissolution of marriage each year for every two marriages. That's true in the United States. In the state of Washington, for example, I'm most familiar with our statistics, we have approximately 40,000 marriages in a given year, and we have about 20,000 dissolutions of marriage in a given year. And many people draw a conclusion from that, that one out of every two marriages fails. It seems to follow if you have a one for two ratio. However, that's not quite accurate. Statistics, as you all know, are very dangerous, is a very dangerous thing to use. I heard somebody recently say that statistics, much like a bikini bathing suit, what is disclosed is certainly interesting, but what is covered is essential. And the statistics frequently hides what you really want to know. And this statistic that I've just given you is that way. If you take people, of the people who marry, somewhere around 72% of the people who marry will stay together until one of them dies. Now that's true even though there is one divorce for every two marriages. Because what's going on is that other people are going to be marrying inside of a group over here on multiple marriages, and you've got some people who are going through 4, 8, 10, 12 dissolutions of marriage. And they are jimmying the statistics over here. So if you look at it in terms of first marriages, almost 3/4 of the first marriages still go through for a lifetime. However, we've got some multiple breakdowns involving essentially the same group of people. You understand what I mean by this. So that's my good news for today. However, my bad news for today is that 25% breakdown is still a lot of breakdown. I was chatting with some of you yesterday and saying that if I owned an automobile that wouldn't start every fourth time I tried to drive away, I would certainly be concerned about the condition of my automobile and try to do something about it. So that's the bad news for the day. Are we making a mistake in thinking of dissolution of relationships? Marriages, consort, family, groupings, joint ventures, parent-child relationships. Are we making a mistake in thinking about that as being a law, a legal problem? Should it be handled in some other way? You know, very few of these cases, and let's talk about dissolutions for a moment, very few of these are really litigated. Over half of all of the civil matters filed in the superior courts in the state of Washington are dissolutions of marriage. However, very few of them are litigated in the sense that there's any argument. They are simply filed. The parties are in complete agreement that they want this relationship terminated. They may even be completely in agreement as to how they want to handle custody of the children and division of the property, and it's simply a formality that they're going through. That they've got to go in and do it before a judge and have it done and signed, and bingo, it's all over. And the great, great bulk of these matters are handled without any argument. In response to a question from Dr. Schutz yesterday, I was pointing out that in the typical no-contest dissolution cases, in court, the time occupied is perhaps less than 2 minutes. It's just how fast you can say your little speech and put on your witness and move off, and the next one steps up and you move off, and it's a conveyor belt operation. You can test that another way. In litigation, contracts, property, and these kinds of litigated things, there are appeals from people who are dissatisfied with the result reached by the trial court. In the state of Washington, in civil cases, there will be one appeal for approximately every 40 cases that a judge hears. But in dissolutions of marriage, there is one appeal for about each 1,000 decisions made by the Superior Court. Because the people know what they want, they aren't arguing, it's there, it's done, It's just as if you'd gone before a notary public and handed him the papers and had him sign it and you're through. Now, in that context, should we think of this as being the kind of problem that we ought to have a judge scrutinizing this thing to see whether or not it ought to be granted or not? Traditionally, the answer has been to that yes, because people having entered into a marriage ought not to be let out unless it has gotten so bad that there is an imminent danger of violence, murder, great harm being done, that the judge's function is to try and say no, no, no. I'd like to share with you a consideration of the case of Ryan against Ryan, a case in Florida. Florida recently adopted, as most states now have, a statute which is called a no-fault dissolution or a no-fault divorce act. Once upon a time, all states had divorces granted only for fault. A petitioning spouse had to come in and show that the other spouse had committed adultery or was guilty of some crime or had done something which was very bad. And you started out by saying, "Your Honor, my spouse, very bad person, he or she has done so and so and so and so." Terrible way, incidentally, of trying to start reconciliation, to lead off with a punch to the jaw. The theory of a no-fault divorce act is that you don't argue about fault anymore. You simply come in and say, "Your Honor, this marriage is irretrievably broken. It's not working." Whatever the reason, it simply isn't working. It's as if you had been in partnership with somebody to grow apples or to build buildings or any other kind of a relationship that you had, a partnership, a contract, and found out that you just couldn't abide working with this other person any longer, so you want to separate. Now, if you and I had a partnership by which we were going to run a chicken farm, and we wanted to separate because it was an unworkable relationship before us, and if we went into the judge and say, "Your Honor, we want now to terminate our partnership and divide our assets and go our separate ways," if the judge were to look at us and say, "Well, that's fine, except one of you will have to commit adultery first," we would think that he had flipped, and indeed I think he would have flipped. Does it make any more sense in a marriage contract to say that there has to be that kind of overt acting out before? Now, in the Ryan case, the husband came to the court and said, "Your Honor, my marriage is a very unhappy one. It's not working. It's irretrievably broken. My wife and I cannot get along, and I'd like to get out." Judge says to the wife, "Is that true?" She says, it's hell on wheels, all right, Your Honor. It's a terrible relationship, but I don't want to let him out. And everything that's happened is his fault, not mine. I am as innocent as the new-driven snow." Well, everybody can sort of say that's probably not true, but let's assume for a moment that it is. Just assume for a moment that we have a case in which Mr. Ryan really is the predominant party at fault, and that Mrs. Ryan is, at least relatively speaking, innocent. Shall we say that Mr. Ryan, the wrongdoer, is entitled to be released from the contractual bonds of marriage? Or shall we say that because he is the party who is the wrongdoer, that we ought to protect the innocent, Mrs. Ryan, the relatively innocent Mrs. Ryan? What do you say? No-fault divorce, you understand, can be read either way. Because you could say that the petitioner, Mr. Ryan, must be the party who is not at fault. Or you can say that fault is simply not something to be discussed. That all you have to do is to say that the parties are not functioning well as a husband and wife, and therefore, whatever the reason, whoever is at fault, if it's not working, be through with it. If we don't want to raise chickens anymore together, whether it's my fault, his fault, or nobody's fault, if we don't want to raise chickens together anymore. Or is it really different when you substitute children for chickens? the difference between rearing children and rearing chickens? I would invite your responses to that query. Should Mrs. Ryan be able to say to Mr. Ryan, "Sorry, husband, you don't get out. I grant you that it's not working well. I don't like it, you don't like it, but I'm not about to let you out." There were no children involved in this case. But of course there will be children involved in many, many of the cases.
Does the judge ask the wife why, if it is hell on earth, she doesn't want to leave?
In effect, he asked her that, and she said, "I think I've got a better toehold on this man when he's married to me than not. If I let him out, he may very well disappear. He may very well marry somebody else. I may not be able to collect money from him as readily. I'd just rather have him under my thumb. It gives me more control, more opportunity to wiggle him. And maybe later, if he comes around with a better offer, I'll let him out."
Maybe she deserved him then.
I think, to go to the bottom line of what I'm telling you right now and disclose some of the problems here, really hadn't meant to do this quite this quickly because it may color your thinking, but ordinarily in talking about grounds for divorce, the conversation in a lawyer's office used to go in the old days something like this. Jim, you're representing the husband in this case, and I'm representing the wife. I'd like to know how much of the assets you're going to give the wife. And Jim would say, "Well, I think maybe I'll go 50-50. Feel generous today." "You're going to do a lot better than that, Jim." "Why so?" "Because we happen to know that you've been running around with Floozy for the last year. I think, Jim, that rather than facing up to the fact that you've been running, your client has been running around with Floozy, he'd like to contribute about 7/10. Now, if he's willing to give my client 7/10, we'll go in on personal indignities which render life burdensome as the grounds. That's kind of nice. If you want to stick with half and half, everybody in town's going to be reading in the newspapers tomorrow morning that you and Floozy have been making trips to Spokane." That, you see, is the harsh reality of the bottom of grounds. And we could document this kind of thing with other kinds of manipulative use. Manipulative, I think, in most people's vocabulary is a bad word. Manipulative means the way that you control outcomes. You manipulate it. It can mean things like pulling the right switches to turn on lights. That's a kind of control. And when you have laws like false laws in divorce, you can control the outcome much more, and frequently that's what you want to do for a client, is to get the best result that you can get for your client. Now, that's at the bottom of this discussion. But right now, on the question of the Ryans, do you think that the law ought to be that the relatively innocent person ought to be able to deny or have a defense? Or do you think that there ought to be no defense in a petition for a divorce? To the dissolution of the marital status now. We'll talk about children, we'll talk about property later, independently. But on terms of the dissolution of the relationship of husband and wife all alone, would you be in favor of eliminating all defenses and let either spouse, no matter how iniquitous they might be, come in and say, "Your Honor, it's all over," sign the piece of paper which recognizes that fact? Let me read you part of the opinion in Ryan against Ryan. "Under the view of the," and I'll substitute the words here, "other judges in this case," that's not what it really says. This one judge is writing an opinion, and he says, "Under the view of the other judges in this case, a wrongdoing husband can come home every Saturday night for 5 years, drunk and penniless because of skirt chasing, gambling, or some other misdeeds. Then he may beat, bruise, and abuse his wife because he's unhappy with himself. And then he will be permitted to go down and get a divorce on printed forms purchased at the department store and tell the trial judge that the marriage is irretrievably broken. Or the offending wife, after jumping from bed to bed with her newfound paramours, chronically drunk, and went at home nagging, brawling, and quarreling, all against the wishes of a faithful husband who remains at home nurturing the children, here you play violin, is permitted to divorce her husband who does not desire a divorce, but rather has one forced upon him, not because of anything he's done, but because the offending wife tells the trial court that her marriage is irretrievably broken. You can tell where this judge is coming from. In my opinion, the offending spouse should not have standing to obtain a divorce if the innocent one invokes the doctrine that he who comes into equity must come with clean hands. If you want equity, do equity. It is the duty of this court to seek a construction of the statute, the Florida statute, irretrievable breakdown, which would support its constitutionality. And what he's saying is, if you don't have this equity rule, you can't ask for relief unless you're willing to give relief. You know, clean hands, clean hands. You like that? No? You don't think, perhaps, that there is such a thing as an innocent and a non-innocent spouse?
Not in an absolute sense, but very likely.
Yeah. Relative degrees.
Yeah.
Shall we start, shall we use that as our key? Because I think we would agree, I think all of us would agree that there's never, I guess there is never anybody who's just completely innocent and one who's completely at fault. It almost always takes two to get a good argument going, or any kind of an argument.
It sort of seems that if the court would say that if one person wants to have the marriage terminated, and the court would say that you can't unless you have all these grounds, that would be irrational. That the court shouldn't be able to say that. That one person, I mean, it takes two people, and then if one person wants to get out, that's enough reason.
It's sort of a self-operative affair. If one person says this is no longer working, it's not, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Because society, I'm making a response now, not necessarily my heartfelt conviction, because it's the law's job to protect the relationship of marriage and not to let it be terminated or dissolved, legally at least, until you can show the kind of wrong.
Well, maybe they have to define marriage. What is marriage?
And here we go right back to the place where we came in again, you see. Is marriage really simply a way of deciding how much tax you have to pay, you know, on which form, the joint return or the single return? Is it simply a way of deciding how property is going to be inherited upon the death of somebody who doesn't have a will? Is it simply a way of deciding which of your assets are subject to the claims of creditors and bankruptcy and which is not? And all the rest of those literally hundreds of legal questions that we've been discussing this week, or is marriage a warm, loving relationship between two persons? I suppose one could say both. And then I suppose I'd have to ask the question that I've been asking all week long. Yes, but can law address that second thing? Can law make a warm, loving, companionable relationship? Or is that quite beyond the capacity of law? And law can only deal with inheritance and property rights and tax and citizenship and social security.
May not the law have in mind to give time for repair work to be done through other media?
And so one will find in the dissolution law of almost every state that there is a so-called cooling off period. After you file your petition, there will be a time in which the law in effect says to the people, go home for 3 months and think about it. See whether or not this is a good step. Rationally consider your problems. Some lawyers, including this one, will sometimes say to a party, please write down on a piece of paper all the things that are bothering you now in your relationship, while I write down on this piece of paper all the problems you're going to have if you enter into a disillusion that are inevitable, you know, two houses, single existences, custody problems, support problems, maintenance problems, division of property, and so forth. And then we will compare these two evils, and I have occasionally lost a client at that point who would say, you know, life, the way it's going on right now is sure bad, but counselor, what you've just written down there is worse. Goodbye. And they walk out unhappily married. Because they would be even less happy with the kind of radical surgery that disillusion sometimes involves, because there is the division with all of the hurts and pains that come with it. On the other hand, occasionally people look at those two things and say, well, I'm suffering now, and I would suffer there, but I would suffer less with the legal solution of disillusion than I am now, so let's go for it. Now, sort of opting for the lesser of two evils, the lesser of two hurts.
I had seemed to hear a story that seems to have repeated itself throughout history, and that is that education, basic education, is at fault. If more of the dollars collected in taxes were dedicated to the basic education of living rather than drawing pretty pictures and telling phony stories from childhood up to adulthood, a lot of the problems that faces society, as you're discussing it now in marriage particularly, would be solved before it ever came to a church.
Yes. How can one expect young children, inexperienced, to rationally understand what marriage involves?
That's exactly what I meant.
Is there some way in which we could educate them, prepare them, help them, marriage preparation courses? You know, societies have tried this from time to time. It's sort of interesting to read the experiments that have been tried. Maybe something can be done, and it's certainly worth the effort. I guess now we are past that one, and we've got the breakdown that we've got to deal with, and I certainly recognize the validity of the point that you're making, and
well,
I can't
remember exactly where in history it was, but there was a time in history when mother took her son aside and gave him the facts of life.
Yeah.
And the father took the daughter aside and gave her the facts of life.
Very interesting.
And as against our system is, mother maybe will tell her daughter something. Maybe she doesn't even know anything to tell her.
Yes. God, more likely, mother and dad will both faint the first time the child raises the question of sex and say, well, they'll tell you all about that at school, or something of that sort. So we do have that problem, but we also have the immediate pressing problem, of course, of the relationship that's deteriorating before us. So we've got to ask the question of whether or not we can devise a system which meets the equity problems, the clean hands problems, or whether we ought to just bag that and say that when the marriage has deteriorated to the point where it can no longer function, then the best thing that the law can do is to acknowledge the accomplished fact, really. It isn't that the court is now going to destroy the relationship. The court is simply going to recognize the fact that the relationship has been destroyed.
Of these many who are being divorced in Washington and other states, do you have any statistics about how many of them may have been related to the church?
No, I don't have accurate statistics on that. I have good statistics on how many of the marriages will have been performed in a church and how many will not have been performed in a church, but of course that's not very meaningful.
No. The reason I ask it, maybe the if many are people, and I think probably there are many that have been active in church, then it seems to me that with the training of our pastors, more emphasis should be placed on their being alert to recognize a situation when developments are beginning, and to try to enter into a counseling relationship. I think of a young couple who thought about the ideal couple on that campus. And in due time they got married, and he entered the ministry. And I don't know if it was 10 or 15 years after marriage, about 10, 12 years, one of them came to me one day, and from the way in which he talked, the marriage was really falling apart. And in raising the question of talking about it, that there's no use. But by taking time and also talking with the wife and letting them leisurely face certain steps they'd taken rather early in life and what it had meant, the demand for a divorce began to erode. Not yet, I think it worked with this for about a year. Not yet thinking about having it sort of reconstituted. But that day came when they wanted to do that. And he is active in the ministry of the ALC today, and they are a happy couple.
The earlier one can get at those problems, as soon as the first danger signals come up, when the first stresses in the family are felt, that's, my wife's terms, would be early intervention. If one can help at that point, of course, there are many cases of the kind that Dr. Schutz is describing. As it deteriorates and as the alienation becomes stronger and stronger, and as the possibility of communication becomes less and less, hostilities mount and build up, the likelihood of any kind of reconciliation decreases. And finally you come to the place where anybody else, I suppose, would say that this is either hopeless or very close to it. Or, alternatively, you get to the place where somebody says, I don't want to attempt any further reconciliation. We discussed that case yesterday. You remember the Wohop case, where the judge orders the people to go out and consult a professional, and they don't want to. And then the question comes, shall we force a form of conciliation upon these people? Illinois had an even more interesting statute. It gave the judge the right to send people out to a religious consultant. You may be a couple Christians, but the judge could send you out to the rabbi, or to the Roman Catholic priest, or to the Swami. That was held unconstitutional, I think properly, because there comes times at which the coercive power of the court ought not, the coercion, you see, you've got to do it or else we'll put you in jail. That ought to be used with caution. The persuasive, educational capacity as a society. You know, you don't have to take this, but if you would like for me to try to help, willing to, is quite a different thing. Well, we come down. Most states today, if a person wants a divorce, you sort of push a button and there it is, as far as the dissolution is concerned. I personally am persuaded that that's more good than it is bad. Like everything else, it's a mixture of good and bad, but I think in most cases it is more good than it is bad, mostly because law is a very blunt instrument, and you cannot make really careful tuning adjustments in life with such a blunt tool as the law. In the days in which we had defenses to divorces, they were based upon the notions of equity. So, for example, the defense of conciliation. If the spouses had separated and one of the spouses came to the other one and said, I know that I have been guilty of misconduct which gives you grounds for divorce, but I would like to try and reconcile. Will you permit me to come back to the house? Shall we try for a week to live together? Wouldn't it be good if we tried to compromise our difficulties? And the other spouse might, in a foolish moment, say, yes, come back and live with me for a week. Let's see how it goes. That was then a condonation, a forgiveness, and the grounds of divorce could no longer be claimed because they had been forgiven. And everyone knows that an offense once forgiven is gone forever. Just like when God forgives our sins, it's gone forever. And so if that week's experiment of reconciliation worked out very badly, and if nothing was left but violence and hatred, and the injured spouse went to the court and said, Your Honor, I want a divorce, and the ground says, what are your grounds? And she says, adultery, beatings, and a whole bunch of stuff. And the husband would say, yes, Your Honor, that's all true. However, she forgave me. And now the judge would say, well, it's forgiven. Now, I'm sorry, ma'am or sir, but you'll have to wait until there's new adultery and you get beaten and bounced off the wall again. Now, that kind of defense can have only one real consequence in the real world, and that is when a party comes to an attorney and says, I think that I can never live harmoniously with my spouse again, but I would like to try. Anything wrong with my trying? And the lawyer is in conscience bound to say, I think you ought to try and reconcile your differences, but I must tell you that if it fails, you will have lost the grounds for divorce. Can you understand the practical consequences of that sort of thing? Or the notion of clean hands. He who asks equity must do equity. There was a defense which was called recrimination. Not everybody is as guilty of wrongdoing as others. So, for example, if one spouse committed adultery and the other spouse was guilty of certain personal indignities, there was an incriminating act and another incriminating act, and they balanced each other off. You didn't have an innocent spouse. You had two guilty spouses. And unless one spouse could say that I'm innocent and that one's guilty, you didn't have a clean hand situation. Well, the courts thought that was kind of fuzzy, and so they started saying, well, the recriminating acts must be of equal severity. So, for example, if it's adultery, that's pretty bad, and if it's just personal indignities, that's not so bad, and they won't balance off. And it got to the ridiculous extent in this state of a case in which a 200-pound man hit a 100-pound woman, and the 100-pound woman hit the 200-pound man back, both swinging as hard as they could, and the court said, well, they both were trying to injure the other one, and you might think that there's recrimination here, but there's really not, because a 200-pound man can hit harder than a 100-pound woman. Now, that kind of really nonsensical treatment of the defenses is the sorts of things which have led to a moving away from the notion of trying to see who is the more innocent and who is the more guilty. There were other defenses, and they had much the same sort of tragic history. Well, let's move to another point. In the process of taking a relationship apart, whether it's marriage, whether it's consorting, whether it's partnership to raise chickens, we must deal with the problem that these people who have lived together in some kind of a relationship have accumulated debts, have accumulated assets, somebody has put something into the common pot and somebody has put something else into the common pot, and we come to the place of dividing the assets. Should the assets be divided on the basis of where they came from? Or should they be divided on the basis of who needs them? Or should they be divided by kind of an arbitrary half and half, and don't talk about where they came from or who needs them? Or do you have some better idea? How shall the assets at the termination of a relationship be divided? While you're running that one back and forth between your ears, would you have a different way of dividing assets for people who had been married to each other and accumulated assets and debts, as contrasted with people who had been living together but were not married legally to each other, but had been accumulating assets and debts.
What if they had children?
Yes, sir, that's a very nice point, and it's another great area of concern here, and the presence of children is going to have consequences upon the claims on property and the payment of debts. Indeed it is. It's a factor that we certainly must take into consideration.
Isn't it rightful to assume that both parties have accumulated this money or whatever, property, because of the climate they lived in together? I mean, maybe the wife aided the husband in dressing a little better and hence he got the better job.
Yes.
Or the husband's contacts were able to lead the wife into a very lucrative side business.
Yes, sir. You're a cheerful, positive thinker. Yes, sir, that frequently happens. You know, the wife puts the husband through law school or a medical school or whatever the training may have been, and certainly she is a contributor. I can also think negatively. Or she harasses him to the point where he is totally ineffective, and he is so distressed that he cannot function in society, and he is indebted because she constantly keeps him, you see. Shall we measure those kinds of goods and evils, the rights and the wrongs, the blessings and the burdens, in dividing the property? Or is that too sophisticated a job for the blunt law to handle? Some states, Louisiana, California, a few others, have sort of thrown up their hands in desperation and said, that's too sophisticated a job for the law to do. It's half and half right down the middle of jointly acquired assets, and for things that they acquired separately, it goes to the person who acquired it. It's much better just to let it go on technical title than it is to try and work out some kind of an equitable need and ability formula. Yes, ma'am.
I think the law in West Virginia is that everybody keeps their own property, at least our neighbors. It's very important to say that the wife says, this is my farm, I inherited it, and in one case down the road from us, the wife pays her husband for working her farm.
Sure, being very careful about title. What a happy way for a husband and wife to live together. Keep a book on every buck that comes in, on every dollar that's spent. Ah, you're over budget. Yeah, it forces one to that kind of an almost legalistic, mine is mine and yours is yours, and law ought not to be dysfunctional if we can help it. But maybe we can't help it. Let me tell you about the Warnings, Mr. and Mrs. Warning. Mr. and Mrs. Warning had been married to each other for a number of years. There were no children. Their marriage was not working at all well, and neither one of them had beaten the other one. But they found grounds for divorce. There was no great big wrong done by either of these people. Both nice folks, and the judge said so. It's a sad story of two nice people who just hadn't been able to make it work. Both apparently in good health. Both had some occupational skills. They agreed to divide their property, all of it, whether they gained it separately or jointly, down the middle, and they separated and went their separate ways. Shortly thereafter, 2 years thereafter, it was discovered that Mrs. Warning had an arthritic condition, not detected before then, which was going to cause her health to deteriorate very rapidly, and did. She could no longer do the job that she had been accustomed to doing. She was soon reduced to living on public assistance, trying to eke out a living in those circumstances because of her physical deterioration. Mr. Warning, on the other hand, had prospered. Now, his business was very good. He was earning at least three times what he had been earning during the time that he and Mrs. Warning had been married to each other. Not because he had changed or was so much better, but because of those happy things that sometimes happen in life that make our work more rewarding than it was otherwise. I can see you already flinching because you know what I'm going to ask you. Mrs. Warding one day came to the court and said, "Your Honor, although I did not ask for alimony at the time that we were divorced because I did not think that I needed it then, I now obviously need it. And my husband, my ex-husband, has it. He has real ability to provide, and I have real need. Ask him to pay me some money every month for my support." The husband said, "A deal is a deal. At the time that we split, it was all over. And you have no continuing claim on me. I'm, as to you, the same as if I had never been married to you." Now, if it had been something that was related to the marriage, you know, it's just like a veteran's claim against the government, a service incurred injury. The husband says, if this was something that related to the marriage, if I'd kept you out of school so you had no training while you put me through school pounding the typewriter, maybe different. But this is totally unrelated. You are saying, in effect, that our marriage wasn't completely terminated by the divorce, that you still got lingering claims against me in the event that you develop arthritis and can't get a job, that you can always come back and sort of play your ace and take it from me. She says, "I am hungry. I am unable to support myself. It's not my fault. We were married. You are making assets. You ought to provide." Now, I'm going to ask you in just a moment how you answer that problem, because the judge, of course, had to answer it, either yes or no, order the husband to pay alimony or not. But before you answer it, recognize that the same argument can be made with every award of alimony. Should you think of the dissolution of marriage as being an erasing of the whole record and starting over clean, divide the assets, yes, that are there then. But then it's clean. Then you go your separate ways without regard to each other in the future, or not. Well, back to the warnings. How do you answer that question?
Isn't legally that the intent to start anew?
Well, it all depends what you say, Your Honor. We'll know the law after the court rules. The legislature has only said that alimony can be provided when in the judgment of the court it should be, you see. A very, very general standard here.
But in order to get alimony, technically, don't you still have to be in the throes of marriage or in the dissolution process?
Oh, alimony is subject to modification as long as both people are alive. Now, indeed, there are technicalities here, and some states say that, well, in order to have it modified, there must be an award of alimony at the time of the decree. Otherwise, there's nothing to modify. And it's for that reason that many of you will have known people who, at the time of the dissolution of their marriage, have been awarded $1 annually. That's because the law of that state says that in order to get a modification any time, you must have an award. $1 annually is okay. You can bump that up to $10,000 a month.
Can it go both
Whereas
ways?
If you get nothing, there's nothing to modify. There are other states which say, ma'am, how technical can you get? If there's a continuing obligation there, you're certainly going to have to recognize it with $1 annually. That's just a pure technicality. People have fought thousands of dollars worth of battles over whether or not there will be an award of $1 a year alimony annually. You understand why now. Well, Mrs. Warning hadn't fought that battle at the time that she went out. So happens in the state of Washington, at the time of the Warning case, no court had ever said that there had to be $1 annually. So the question is open. Take it either way you wish, ladies and gentlemen. You are the court. You can now decide, because the legislature has not prescribed. You can make the decision. I'm asking you the usefulness function. How shall you spell out your convictions of being helpful to people in this situation?
Mr. Warning had not remarried.
Mr. Warning had remarried. If that makes any difference.
Well,
Were they still under the jurisdiction of the court?
Yes, the continuing jurisdiction of the court goes on as long as the parties live.
It does, really?
In dissolution actions, yes, it does. There's a continuing jurisdiction. You have to give notice again, of course, and give notice that there's going to be a hearing, but the power and the jurisdiction continues.
Well, a divorce isn't a final settled thing.
We're trying to decide that, Your Honor.
As judge, I'd say no. If I were a pastor working with the case, I'd try to get
Mr. Warding to contribute voluntarily.
Yes.
But you would feel that the more useful law is the no answer?
Mm-hmm.
That it ought to be as clean a break as possible?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That you ought to force battle for the $1 at the time of the dissolution? I know you didn't mean that, Dr. Schutz, but the practical consequence of the no answer to Mrs. Warning is a clear signal to me and to every other lawyer that from here out, although the parties don't want to fight about that $1, I've got to say to my client, sir or madam, because alimony can be paid to either spouse now, must tell you now that this is your time to get that $1 a year alimony or you're through forever. Incidentally, I must do that, because if I do not, and the arthritic condition develops a year or two later, I am vulnerable to malpractice actions.
Yeah, I was going to ask you whether she had been informed about this clause.
We didn't know what the law was in the state of Washington at that time, and lawyers frequently in dissolution actions try not to engender needless, in quotation marks, arguments between the spouses, because you try, or hope to try, to make this as free of animosity and argument as possible, and so you don't go around manufacturing arguments. So in all probability, Mrs. Warning had not been told, well, I really think you ought to go in and ask for alimony. Probably because the lawyer would have been thinking that she could come in later, or maybe because they didn't think of it. That's a possibility too.
Can alimony be adjusted up and down?
Mm-hmm. If there is alimony which is capable of modification, it can be increased or decreased. Yes, ma'am, up or down.
Mm-hmm.
You people are acting just like most judges. You don't want to face that issue, do you? You understand the issue. Don't try and hoodwink me. You've got, Dr. Schutz has spoken and given us a decision which has some nice things to say about it and some terrible consequences about it also, which is the uncomfortable position of any decision in law. Yes, ma'am?
Aren't there some recent developments now about that not only the husband pays alimony, but the wife sometimes also has alimony?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Indeed, there are.
One would have to pay $1 for the other per year if they decide not to have it?
No. It might be that such a decision could be reached, that it would be the order of the court that both spouses have a continuing obligation to pay something which can be increased or decreased as need and ability develops in succeeding years, or at the time of the dissolution it can be cut clean. This is it. You're through. It's all over. You never need to talk to each other again. Which is better here? Which kind of surgery? You're trying to evade the sharpness of the question. You must answer. If you don't answer, as I told you before, a couple days ago, for those of you who weren't here, if you don't answer in the state of Washington within a relatively short time, the state will simply withhold your salary and you will not be paid again as a judge until you resolve the question. Answer. Yes, sir. You want to answer? Yes, sir.
I think that if I were her lawyer, this lady's lawyer, I would advise her to lean very heavily on her husband's generosity without legal aid.
Without legal aid. She tried, as a matter of fact, and Mrs. Warning really, it is a sad case. I'm going to leave this book here in the library someplace. It's got the Warning case in it and all the rest of these cases. If you want to cry, read the case. She deteriorated. Her brothers lived with her. They were ill and old. They were going around the community. They were denied social. They were denied public assistance because they didn't fit any of our categorical relief systems. They were picking up scraps of wood. They were rummaging through garbage cans. It's better to make people fight that out, even though it's going to lead to controversy in the typical divorce action, and struggle for the $1. It's better to engender that kind of animosity and trauma.
No, because actually it was ignorance than...
Because in the last analysis,
you know, she needed it.
This pain is not as painful as that pain. I mean, if your liver is going bad, get rid of it before it leads to more trouble. Yes, ma'am?
Well, is there anything in law that would say that, okay, if the action has been decided, except in the case if somebody becomes dependent upon society, on the government, or, you know, welfare, society, then all means should be taken to make arrangements to keep him off of this dependency on society, and so therefore the husband should be responsible.
Yes, I think I read you. Where shall the misfortunes of an individual be born? Shall they be born by those to whom that individual has been related in the past, by family or by marriage? Or shall we cast that burden on society generally? That's what we're talking about, you see. If a person has the misfortune of having a child who is born incompetent, shall that person carry that burden as a parent all through life? Or shall the burden of that misfortune be carried by society generally? If people who are married have the misfortune of having their marriage collapse, shall they carry the risks? You know, I can't even control my ex-spouse's conduct anymore. He or she may be leading a life most disreputable, most damaging. I can't even interfere in the conduct to try and protect myself from further harm. He or she may be squandering, rolling in the gutter, misbehaving, and saying, why should I work? I can always tap good old Vern. Or are you going to make that kind of obligation on my part dependent upon whether or not the spouse behaves according to the way that you think they ought to? These are difficult problems to resolve. The law and the warning case was that Mr. Warning had to pay. Mostly because the taxpayer said, you know, this is really a choice. It's either the taxpayers or Mr. Warning. And since most of us are taxpayers and very few of us are Mr. Warning, there are more people who thought Mr. Warning ought to pay than the taxpayers ought to pay. That's kind of where that one comes down. Although there are other people who argue that once married, you are always married. That it's not dissoluble.
That
you can let them separate from each other in terms of no longer cohabiting, but that the lingering aspects, it's not the kind of thing that can be terminated, watch this now, any more than you can terminate the relationship of a parent and a child. People have argued that marriage causes a change in status so that you are now forever bound. I don't know what adjective to use next. Spiritually, morally, till death, you see, that having accepted this responsibility, although you've been unable to live together without being at each other with baseball bats, and so we permit you to go apart from each other, at least out of the range of a baseball bat, but still your obligation to each other goes on because it's not dissoluble.
Even with the new law now of the alimony can be $1, even with that law, I mean, now if you decide after your marriage is over that you neither wants any alimony, that's it, that in 2 years if my husband, something happens to him, that I would have to support him?
No more in Washington.
No.
In some states, yes. In Washington, since 1973, the husband and wife can, if they like, at the time of the dissolution, enter into a contract with each other that says, this is it. You go your way, and I go mine, and there will never be anything more. Or they can say that we both recognize the continuing obligation to each other, contingent upon health and assets and so forth. Husband and wife can, by contract, adjust that. Do you like that?
I like that better.
You like that better?
I don't know.
Yeah.
What's the percentage? You sound like a horse track person. Into those kinds of contractual arrangements. Very difficult to tell, you see, because the great majority of dissolution actions come in, many of them on pro se, that is, representing themselves without attorneys. Nothing is said. When the court says, do you have property to divide, the answer is no in these pro se cases. We've already divided it. And the court says, any argument, the other person doesn't even appear. There's no opposition. The court simply enters the decree, which is in most simple form, and nobody knows. You wait till the future event to find out. I have 4 minutes. I'm going to take that clock. I've got more time on that clock than I have on mine. One more huge block of problems here, which we can only touch in the dissolution action, and that is, what do we do about children? Now, we have just been through a rather difficult analysis of what do we do about property and support between the spouses or the adults. Now, what do we do about the care, the nurture, the education of the children? Custody problems. Who should have the custody? Shall we let the other spouse visit the children? More and more one is seeing in the dissolution of marriage where there are children something called joint custody. Both spouses are said to have custody. That means that they've got to get together once in a while and agree upon how the child is to be reared. Do you like that one? Do you like the concept that visitation rights and custody rights should be subject to modification? Mm-hmm. Let me tell you about Mr. and Mrs. Thompson. Children, disillusion. Mrs. Thompson, who had not completed her high school education and who wanted to see some of the world before she settled down, still a relatively young woman, agreed rather quickly that Mr. Thompson ought to have custody of the two children. He took the custody of the children, but Mr. Thompson, a carpenter who built on large projects in various places, he was not a man who stayed home, his work took him from place to place, said as a practical matter, I can't stay home and dress the children and bathe them and feed them. He went down to Tacoma, a city in Seattle, in the state of Washington near Seattle, where his sister lived. And he said, sister, will you help me? And she said, yes. So she gave the day-to-day care for the children, huh? Mm-hmm. That went on for 10 years. Mr. Thompson, the father, drifting in and out. Drifting is bad connotations. Mr. Thompson working, and sometimes in Alaska, sometimes in New Mexico, and sending money home, providing support, coming home when he could, seeing his children, writing them letters and so forth, but the children who were infants at the time of the dissolution, identifying their aunt as being the person that they loved, who woke them up in the morning, who fed them, who put them to bed and so forth. In the meantime, Mrs. Thompson, the ex-Mrs. Thompson, having now done what she wanted to do and having settled down, married a very fine man up in Alaska. She has a good marriage. They are fine, reputable folks, the ex-Mrs. Thompson and her new husband. She then came down and said, my husband and I want the children. And since you, father, have very little contact with them anyway, out of the sheer necessity of your work, and since their aunt has no claim to them, she is not the parent, nor was she awarded custody. And since everybody knows that mothers are better for children than fathers, I want the children. The judge did something which at that date was a little unusual. He brought the two children. It's done commonly now. A little unusual at the date of the Thompson case. He brought the children into his chambers and said, your mother would like to have your custody. Would you like to go with your mother? Answer, no. Oh, you love your father more than your mother. Terrible, terrible question to ask children. No, you don't? No, we love our aunt. Said the judge, Let's try something, shall we? Go up to Alaska and spend a few months with your mother and her new husband and see if it will work. No, said the children. The judge says, look, you can't refuse to obey an order of a court. They went. Crying, incidentally.
How old were the children?
Children this time were 8 and 10. No, I'm sorry, 10 and 12. They've been just infants, one newborn and the other one 2 years old at the time of the disillusion, 10 and 12. And they spent a couple months with their mother and the new husband in Alaska. Then they returned, and the judge says, now it's going to be all right, isn't it? And they said, no, now we really know. And we don't want to go with mother. We want to stay with our aunt. Mother says, look, the aunt's not in this picture at all. She has no legal claims. Children said, think of us. Judge says, quiet. This is a discussion between mother and father as to who owns the child, who gets custody of the children. And I'm of the opinion, says the judge, that I've got to settle this one between either the father or the mother. All right, court.
Father?
Yeah.
Father?
He had legal custody of him at first?
He had legal custody. Of course, it's subject to modification.
And he did the best he could.
He did the best he could, but of course he really is no big figure in the children's life.
No.
But he gave us up to.
Provided a good home.
Provided a good home.
Surrogate mother.
Pardon? He was the surrogate mother.
The aunt was.
Anybody for the aunt?
Well, the aunt comes with the father, does she not?
Oh, yeah, that's
all. Yeah,
that's
so we leave it the way it is.
So what you're really saying is you like the custody of the aunt.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
My aunt should get a divorce and then marry the father.
you missed the lead-in line. She was his sister. But it's not a bad idea. And says, I'll not take the children to my new home with me, dragging them away from the aunt. Anybody think that the children ought to decide this?
Well, they did. They wanted to stay with them.
You think that the court might say to the kids, all right, kids, this one is really heads and tails, you know, between father and mother, if it is. And I'll let you decide. You got a 10 and a 12-year-old. Anybody think that the children ought to be entitled to have a lawyer to come in and argue their position? And the husband and wife each got a lawyer arguing their position. You think the kids ought to have a lawyer to come in and argue their position?
Yeah, who would articulate that to the lawyer, though?
It's kind of tough. Do you think of 10-year-olds and 12-year-old children, are they capable of making this kind of a decision?
Yeah.
If you say yes, I'm going to ask you about 6 years and 4 year olds.
Yeah. Where are you?
How about the aunt? Do you think she ought to be able to intervene in the action, hire her attorney and come in and argue, you know, Your Honor, deprive the children and let me adopt them because, after all, I have been, since their infancy, their functioning parent? She ought to have standing.
Does she even want them? We don't even know that.
Yes, desperately. As a matter, the full evidence, you can read the Thompson case too if you like in this material. The full evidence shows that the aunt did her level best to cooperate. She explained to the children, you know I love you dearly. However, you are not my children. You are the biological issue of this woman and this man. And of course, the children look at the woman and say, who is she? Now, they hadn't even seen this woman.
She had no contact with these children?
No contact with these children.
Oh, come on.
No contact with these children. But remember now, all the evidence, including, incidentally, a very nice letter from her pastor, who said this really is a good family. And I believe it. I believe I'm willing to take the facts now that she and her new husband are now fine folks. But does that make a difference?
But at that time, she left the children.
The children were spent a couple months, I think actually three, in Alaska with them and did not like it. They'd gone up there screaming and protesting the whole way. They wanted to be down in Tacoma with their aunt.
Seems like the kids managed pretty well to get through that initial divorce without a lot of trauma. And that's what that that would be doing is causing the trauma 10 years later when they, by the skin of their teeth, made it through with being, you know, having a stable home life and well-adjusted and stuff. I think it would be horrible to have them.
Yeah, and extrapolate that one out, of course, to every disillusion action in which children are involved, every modification. You get these problems again. Well, I should tell you how the case came out. The court ordered that the children be sent to their mother, saying that he thought that it was a bad lesson in civics for children to oppose the decree of a court.
Who was that?
You're not impressed by that decision?
No.
The Superior Court judge who made that decision, the father immediately appealed to the state Supreme Court. So we got another shot at it. Now I call you into session as the Supreme Court.
We call the judge.
You now are reviewing the decision made by the Superior Court judge. Shall we reverse him? On what evidence, incidentally? He's the one that heard the parties, saw the parties, talked to the children, saw all the evidence. All that we have before us is the written record. An appellate court never hears witnesses. They never see the parties. Simply have the record. There's a man down there who the electorate of Pierce County voted into office as a judge. I know that you have never have any idea what. I suspect there's not a person in this room who can list for me the 9 justices or the 7 justices of their state Supreme Court, even though you probably elected them all. We don't pay much attention to that. The Supreme Court, you are now the Supreme Court, has the decision from good Judge X down there in Tacoma, who has heard the evidence and seen the parties and presumably exercised his best judgment. Shall we reverse him?
Yes.
On what grounds?
I need to go back to the Chinese. That mother had unmothered herself, just like a king can unking himself. She had not acted like a mother. She had disqualified herself from being a mother.
For 10 years.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Although she was a biological mother, that's all she was.
Let's read that one backwards to the time of the dissolution decree in any dissolution involving children. If one spouse does not insist upon active participation in the children's life. You know, I got to have them at least one day a week. Mm-hmm. I've got to have some voice. Is that spouse unmothering or unfathering herself or himself?
I think so.
Yeah.
Therefore, are we setting up, if we reverse the trial judge, are we setting up a situation in which we are compelling a fight over custody? In every case.
Seems like that $1 alimony thing.
All over again.
All over again.
And we are caught between the devil and the deep blue sea here.
The court then could investigate each person and see who would be financially and whatever.
Emotionally, etc., etc.
More responsible.
You know, the best.
Is there a legal basis for appealing a Supreme Court's decision?
When you got to the Supreme Court, you've had it.
Well, I got the impression that the first judge was anti-childhood. Soon I got the news.
The first judge, the Superior Court judge, was saying that he had to operate on the presumption that the mother, having been shown to be a fit, proper, decent, wholesome person, with a fit, proper, decent, wholesome family, and being legally the parent in opposition to a father who was a fit, wholesome, decent person without a family, except his sister, the aunt, who was not in anything like daily contact with the children. The children didn't like their father any more than they liked their mother, really. They liked their aunt. And the shoal that we've gone aground on here is thinking of the legality of the family, the father or the mother, rather than saying what's for the best interest of the child. And maybe neither the father nor the mother ought to be given custody. Perhaps it ought to be given to the aunt. Maybe we ought to listen to the children. Except, do you, would you really believe that, those of you who have reared children, and you know what a 10-year-old's thinking pattern is? I don't know about you, but our daughter ran away every once in a while. Sometimes she got two houses up the street. You know, there were days in which she didn't like her mother much better than she liked her father.
Mine took off when she was two the first time.
And shall we let a child with a child's mind make those decisions? Don't say no too quickly. But don't say yes too quickly either. But remember that you are judges and now you must decide. And so you get to share a little bit in the particular excitement of a court. Yes, ma'am.
The pastor knew the mother and the husband that well. Why did they really want children? And if it's children they really love, why didn't they have some then? She's not too old yet, apparently. Or adopting children to love.
Yeah.
Rather than create all this unpleasantness and make a traumatic experience for the children.
Why can't parents at the time of dissolution of the marriage be loving and generous and think of the welfare of their children?
Because they're emotionally incapable of...
Because 82% of them are in such a state of stress at that point that they don't even know how to clean their house efficiently or run their office or anything else. If they can't make the decision, who's going to make the decision? A judge? A judge who has about a hour's information being given by partisan parties without ample workup, who must flow these cases through, 20,000 of them a year, most of them representing children. The cost, ladies and gentlemen, of doing a careful investigation on the welfare of those children would be staggering. For that amount of money, you could probably build 5 miles worth of highway. Obviously, that's much better to build a highway for 5 miles than it is to take care of kids. So our society has simply not been willing to make the investments that are necessary if one supposes that we have the skills to do it in a way. Or maybe we must conclude that the law is a blunt, blunt instrument, and that the end result of falling out of life in the spirit is pain, and that the best you can do is to choose the least damaging of two alternatives, and somebody's got to make the decision, and it's a hard go. Well, the Supreme Court in the Thompson case affirmed children go to the mother, and the legislature came howling back after that and said, "That's a stinker, Your Honor." They didn't say that. But that was the burden of the message. The legislature enacted a new statute which says that third parties, like aunts, can come into court and argue. So now we got three contestants, huh? Mm-hmm. And they also said that a child is entitled to be represented. And so lawyers today are representing children. It's a little odd sometimes to look over to a crying, rather damp bundle and say, "What do you want me to do now?" And a lawyer finds himself in a peculiar position of having a rather inarticulate client at times when you represent the interests of the child, but that's another story, and we're over time.
You had an intelligent legislature.
Yeah. I thought so, Dr. Schutz, because I drafted the act. Yeah, we're over time. It's been a real pleasure being with you people these last few hours. I had a lot of fun, and obviously we've just sort of touched the tops here. I hope that you're less comfortable now than you were when we started the discussion about the problems of law and family. And
let's send them away with a very good feeling, with a heart.